Democrats picked up their first state legislative seat in 2018 Tuesday, and it happened in Wisconsin's 10th district. Democrat Patty Schachner defeated her Republican opponent Adam Jarko for the open seat by a comfortable margin of about 10 points. Democrats captured a district that Republicans have held since 2001. It's where we'll begin Week in Review on this January 19th. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Eugene Kane is a former columnist with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Eugene, welcome to the program.
Hey there, Kate. Good to talk to you. I hope I don't slip up and call you Joy sometime during this discussion.
That's okay. Don't worry about it. Chris Lotto is here as well, a former communications director for the Republican Party of Wisconsin and a GOP campaign consultant. Chris, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Kate, and good morning, Eugene.
Good morning.
Well, let's first start on this special election. Patty Schachner, the chief medical examiner for St. Croix County, will take the seat that had been held for 17 years by former state senator Sheila Harsdorff following Tuesday's special election. Governor Scott Walker called the results a wake-up call for Republicans in Wisconsin, and House Speaker Paul Ryan weighed in.
Typically, we've held this seat. And we lost this seat last night. So, yeah, I think we should pay attention to it.
So, Chris, do you agree with Governor Walker and Speaker Ryan? What's next for Republicans?
Yeah, it doesn't bode particularly well for Republicans. Governor Walker called it a wake-up call, and he's right. It might have been a wake-up call for the governor as well. You know, I've always said that Scott Walker is pretty close to bulletproof in terms of his reelection chances. And I would still hold to that for a host of reasons, but this certainly exposes some vulnerabilities in Wisconsin, which means that, you know, Republicans can't take anything for granted. And I think that's why you're seeing the GOP show of force this week. You know, the announcements about the ground game being set up across the state, a number of Republican offices being opened up around Wisconsin, field offices. You know, they're getting the grassroots organization in place now and getting ready, which, you know, they obviously have to do in any event. But this year, there's a real urgency there. I think the real troubling aspect to this for Wisconsin Republicans is that the state Senate race, you know, may well indicate dissatisfaction with the GOP, not just at the state level, but at the national level as well, because this is an area of the state that Trump did well in a couple of years ago. A Republican state senator has held that seat for a number of years. So, you know, the question is this the Trump effect, in which case, I'm not sure what state Republicans are going to be able to do to counteract that. Trump is obviously a very polarizing figure. He's going to remain so this year, I'm sure. And that really doesn't bode well for Wisconsin Republicans, frankly. So it remains to be seen. But, you know, it does suggest that indicators such as the record low unemployment we're seeing and other economic indicators perhaps don't matter as much to voters as we'd like to hope.
Eugene, what do you make of this race? What do you think Democrats can take away from it?
Well, I have to be honest and tell you, I think outside of some real plugged-in political types, I don't think a lot of people in the Milwaukee area even knew there was a special election. So the end result is all the publicity about how, oh, wow, the Democrats won this election in Wisconsin. That has actually become a sort of marker for a lot of people who were asleep and who probably just assumed, well, you know, this is Wisconsin, Republican Scott Walker, he's going to win again. There's no way of counteracting it. I think it gives now a glimmer of hope, even more than a glimmer. It's like a chink in armor that now I can see a lot of stepped-up advocacy and participation, really, among voters who, and if they've been paying attention, there have been a number of Democratic victories across the country since Trump was elected. This is another one, and I'm not predicting a blue wave or anything, although a blue wave would be kind of interesting for 2018. But clearly, people are on edge. I saw Scott Walker's tweet storm the night this happened, and I'm like, oh, yeah, he's very worried. He's very worried. So I guess all you can do is say that it was significant, and I don't think a lot of people predicted how significant it's going to be.
So, Chris, you're a consultant. What would you advise Republicans do as we continue on toward election season?
I think You know, there's a lot of things, a lot of headwinds working against Republicans. And again, if you buy into the theory that at least to a certain extent, Wisconsin Republicans may end up paying the price for what's happening at the federal level, that's a tough thing to counterbalance. But I think you're seeing with Governor Walker's touting this week of you know what's happening with unemployment levels, you know, which are at historic lows in Wisconsin right now. You saw him roll out some additional welfare reforms, obviously, which are certainly pitched to the base, but are also an attempt to sort of get a larger workforce going in Wisconsin and get more people off the welfare rolls and into work. You're seeing some of those things start to happen now, and I think it is up to Wisconsin Republicans to make the case and perhaps to a certain extent separate themselves from the federal stuff and say, you know, Trump is Trump. The Republicans in Congress are doing what they're doing. We're busy here in Wisconsin getting things done, and you have to reiterate what they've been able to do in the last couple of years because they've accomplished quite a bit, and the Republican base should be fired up about that. But it's really getting out and starting to tell that story and being forceful about it.
We are in Week in Review on this Friday. Eugene Kane is with us, a former columnist with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And we have Chris Lotto in the studio with us, a former communications director for the Republican Party of Wisconsin and a GOP campaign consultant. We have you as well. You can join in this conversation about the week's developments at 800-642-1234. Do you see the Senate seat in the 10th district as a wake-up call in some way for Republicans? Did you vote in the special election? Did you know it was happening? 800-642-1234. Also, when is the right time to shut down the Lincoln Hills Correctional Facility? Is the governor rushing it? Are legislative leaders dragging their feet? You can join in on the issue over Lincoln Hills that came up this week. 800-642-1234. Send an email to ideas@WPR.org. Turning to Lincoln Hills here for the moment, at least, unless we have some calls coming in about the District 10 election. Governor Walker announced this month that he wants to convert the Lincoln Hills School for Boys to an adult facility, spend $80 million to build 5 new juvenile prisons around the state. Initially, he wanted to start the process in 2019. We heard this week that he wanted to get approval from lawmakers this year, 2018. Eugene, do you agree with Governor Walker on speeding up the process?
Well, I'm cautious because having covered some of the Lincoln Hill problems when I was a columnist for the Journal Sentinel, I know it's kind of strange that the reform he's talking about is breaking it up, making it 5 smaller facilities, but the overriding problem at Lincoln Hills has never been the size of the facility. It has been the culture and the way inmates or the younger people who were sent there were being treated. And as an African-American, I have to say, since the majority of that population is going to be African-American, I'm concerned what the approach is in terms of solving the problem of how they are treated and whether breaking it up is actually the best way to solve that problem. Although I have to admit, I've heard from some people involved in the situation in Milwaukee who say they have advocated for breaking it up into smaller pieces. So I think that's something Walker is doing that actually some people on the Democratic side have suggested, but there's still pushback. And again, my main thing is that I don't care if it's the same size or smaller sizes. It's the institutional nature of Lincoln Hills that has to be changed. That's the way I've always thought about it.
Chris, Speaker Robin Voss told reporters this week he and other Assembly Republicans are considering their own plan to break up Lincoln Hills School for Boys by having more teen inmates held in county facilities. Voss didn't say if he would act before the legislative session ends this spring, but did note that county facilities like those in his home county of Racine are less expensive than state facilities. So what do you think of this idea?
Yeah, Governor Walker came out and said, you know, we want to deal with this now rather than keep, you know, kicking the can down the road to 2019 and beyond. So the problem with that is Governor Walker has really been embracing proposals that came from Democrats and a Democrat timeline. Democrats were the ones who were saying, don't kick this can down the road. And now Walker has come around and said, yeah, I'm with you on that. So It appears that Republicans in the legislature want something to say about that, as should be expected. So to date, we're hearing that Republican leaders may not agree with that accelerated timeline and that they want to take some time to make sure that the plan that they're going to do is the right one. And you mentioned Speaker Voss. He has indicated that he would prefer a go slower approach. And I think both Republican caucuses in the Senate and Assembly would like to take a look and see what their options are and weigh those things instead of just pushing forward as soon as possible. So certainly Robin Voss has advocated a go-slower approach, considering all the angles. He did not rule out the possibility this week that, a youth prison plan could be finalized this year. But I think they want to take the temperature of their respective caucuses before saying that they're on board with this.
Eugene, cautious, take the temperature of their caucuses. What do you make of that?
Again, I think what's missing from the equation is the treatment of these young folks who are assigned to these facilities. And then the overriding concern for Voss is saving money. I mean, again, I get to the institutional nature of what these facilities are for. Are they like warehouses for young offenders? Or is there any kind of rehabilitation or an attempt to kind of deal with this population while they're so young and so easily perhaps, brought around to the right way of doing things? But it sounds to me like they just want to perpetuate a criminal justice system for these young people. And again, I'm concerned particularly about the young African-American males who are in danger of always being indoctrinated into a prison system while young and then just keep perpetuating it as they get older. So the political side of this, again, is a sign to me of how politicians don't really take into consideration the human cost of all of this. I mean, we're talking about warehousing these young people like a budget problem, and that's just not the way to solve the problem in my mind.
Well, Doris called in from Rice Lake. She couldn't stay with us. She says she has a real problem with the governor's plan. If he wants to spend all that money, put it into treatment centers, Doris says, instead of more prisons. Chris Lotto?
That's one approach that people can propose. I think that if you look at Republicans and how they consider this issue, that there can be a rehabilitation aspect to it, but there is a cost to be paid by society, and I think that's a much more fundamental argument over how to handle young offenders as opposed to just dealing with the issues at Lincoln Hills, which has been obviously a dysfunctional a part of the system. And Eugene, as he acknowledged, knows this as well and reported on it in the past. But I think that gets to a much deeper issue that I don't think anybody in the legislature is prepared to deal with right now. I think they're dealing with the short-term issue of how to deal with the aftermath of the Lincoln Hill situation and how do we go forward.
And you can join in on this conversation at 800-642-1234. You're listening to Week in Review. We're moving through the top state and national stories of the week with guests from different political perspectives. Eugene Kane and Chris Lotto are with us for this installment. Eugene is a former Milwaukee Journal Sentinel columnist. Chris Lotto is former communications director for the Republican Party of Wisconsin and a GOP campaign consultant. When we come back, we will discuss the Government Accountability Board and get your thoughts on where that issue stands this week. Once again, you can call in 800-642-1234. Should Wisconsin lawmakers approve leadership for the Ethics Commission and Elections Commission? Is this a partisan move or does it make sense beyond politics? What do you think of the job done by leaders in charge of running elections and enforcing ethics laws? 800-642-1234. Back in a moment. You're listening to Week in Review. We're moving through the top state and national stories of the week with guests from different political perspectives. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Eugene Kane and Chris Lotto are with us for this installment. Eugene is a former Milwaukee Journal Sentinel columnist. Chris Lotto is former communications director for the Republican Party of Wisconsin and a GOP campaign consultant. You can get into the mix as well at 800-642-1234. Should Wisconsin lawmakers approve leadership for the Ethics Commission and Elections Commission? Is this a partisan move, or does it make sense beyond politics? 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. The leaders of the Wisconsin agencies that run elections and enforce ethics laws are engaging in really a public relations campaign to save their jobs, including tweets, personal letters designed to show their nonpartisanship. It comes in advance of a scheduled Senate vote next week to reject their confirmations. And this is the latest step since Attorney General Brad Schimmel released a report last month that looked into the source of leaked information during the John Doe probe that was in the news. It shows that the information came from the now defunct Government Accountability Board, which the Ethics and Elections had worked for. So, Chris Lotto, first, what are you watching for here?
Well, I think right now the state Senate is poised to take action on Tuesday regarding both Brian Bell as the Ethics Commission head and Michael Haass as the Elections Commission head. And it doesn't look good for either one. As you said, they're really doing what strikes me as not unprecedented, but quite a PR push in the last few days, holding news conferences, releasing letters, and really making their case. I think for both of them, though, you know, the stink of the GAB still hangs in the air for Republicans. You'll recall, you know, back in 2015, the GAB was disbanded because of how it was handling its investigations. And that was right after the state Supreme Court concluded that a sweeping investigation of Walker's campaign was unfounded, excessive. So I think with that still hanging in the air, with the Schimmel report from last month, that it's pretty clear to me that Bell and Haass's days are numbered, and perhaps the Senate is recognizing it's time to just clean house and start fresh with the heads of these commissions.
Eugene, do you see it as time to clean house?
Well, I was interested in what Chris had to say about it, because to tell the truth, I don't follow it as closely, but I do get a sense that what's happening is, you know, am I mistaken, or is this basically Republicans messing with each other? I mean, it sounds to me like this is another case of Republicans in control of government who are basically running up against problems of their own makings. And Wisconsin, which has always had this reputation for such clean government, I mean, since I've been here 30 years, I've never really seen it as exceptionally clean, because we always have our little pockets of corruption and pockets of people who just want to kind of circumvent the rules. So I'm interested in what's happening, but to be honest, the idea of the government accountability has always been a misnomer to me. So even when they had that active board, I was like, you know, most regular people don't see government for being accountable for very much. So this is an interesting scandal. I'm just wondering to see exactly how it's going to turn out, because I don't think a lot of people are really that connected to it.
Well, Nate in Milwaukee watches this issue very closely. Nate, go ahead.
Hi, thank you. I actually have been researching it recently, including looking at the some of the court cases, like Buckley versus Valeo, the Citizens United case, and both Wisconsin Right to Life versus Barland cases. And in none of them does it say that it was legal for Scott Walker's campaign to coordinate with supposedly independent groups, and then use that coordination as a way to hide where his money was coming from. Specifically, page 81 and 82 of the second Ireland decision says it's okay for the GAB to require independent groups to sign an oath saying they're not coordinating with a political candidate or their people. So I think some fact-checking whenever the Republicans say the GAB was partisan is not only in order, but the GAB had rules about being independent, and there's bipartisan support for these commissioners. So the partisanship is only coming from one direction here.
Let's get Chris to respond. Nate, thanks.
Yeah, I don't think there is bipartisan support for these commissioners, which is why you're seeing Tuesday's vote. But I wanted to circle back on Eugene's point, because I think it's a good one, actually. I think that, you know, the party in power is always going to be the one that's got the target on its back. And I think that there is, frankly, no such thing as a truly nonpartisan board. I think that's almost impossible to achieve. And I think that's what Eugene was maybe getting at a little bit, that this idea that we can have a truly independent a voice that's connected to state government in this way, investigating things, I think is impossible to achieve. And you're always going to be, you know, if you're in the majority and you're being investigated, you're going to be the aggrieved party. And that cuts both ways. That could be with Democrats in power as well. So I think that's where you get into some of the thorniness of, you know, are these truly nonpartisan agencies? And one of these gentlemen, Brian Bell, this week came out and accused one of the attorneys back, I think, at GAB of being excessively partisan and running around it, you know, in favor of Democrats. So it's kind of turned into a little bit of a nest of vipers. But I think that's what you're going to get when you try for nonpartisanship, and I don't think it's possible to achieve.
Let's go to Eloise in Wautoma. Hi, Eloise.
Yes. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
You know, these programs have been around in Wisconsin for a number of years, and they've been doing a good job checking on both Democrats and Republicans. I don't understand why they want to do away with them now. You know, they work, and they should be working for the people, not for the Democrats or the Republicans. I'll take my comments off the phone.
Eloise makes a point that these are agencies that should be working for the people. Eugene?
Wholeheartedly agree. But, you know, here in reality world, that doesn't seem to always apply.
Well, let's turn our attention now to national news. The House passed a stopgap funding bill late last night. The measure now faces uncertainty in the Senate. We were discussing that extensively last hour as Republican congressional leaders are trying to avoid a government shutdown by tonight. We saw Paul Ryan, House Speaker Paul Ryan, in action yesterday, rounding up GOP leaders. So, Chris, what do you make of this potential partial government shutdown?
You know, it's such a breaking, developing story where I think we're going to see more developments happening throughout the day. I think you pretty much encapsulated what happened last night. The House took action, the Senate did not, and that's where the real problem lies. I think that, you know, it's not a good look for Republicans. Your guest last hour made the point.
Republicans are all in control.
Right. So they've got the White House and they've got Congress. So I don't think it reflects particularly well on Republicans, although I do think there is some blame to go around for everyone. I think that at this point, acknowledging the idea that, for example, the immigration, the DACA legislation is something that both sides want to see something happen on it. So there is agreement there. I think the CHIP reauthorization, the Child's Health Insurance Program, which, again, you discussed last hour, it's a revenue or cost neutral program that should be extended. And I think everybody agrees on that. But I think, frankly, you know, and we shouldn't be surprised by this, but we're seeing a deeply dysfunctional Congress in action, and both sides have to shoulder some of the blame for not being willing to step up and try to figure something out and work together. And I think that, you know, Republicans are going to take their fair share of heat, as we've already said, but I think Democrats are playing politics as well. And to say that one side is totally clean and the other isn't, I think is being disingenuous.
And Eugene, before I go to you on this, I can mention as well that people can weigh in on this. What is the right move for members of Congress and the president in the potential for a government shutdown? What can Wisconsin's delegates do to keep the nation afloat while representing the state's values? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can send a tweet at WPR Mornings. Eugene, you've been watching the back and forth. Also, a real blame game going on between Democrats and Republicans. What do you make of this partial government shutdown that could possibly happen by midnight?
Well, I'm glad everybody seems to acknowledge that we do have a government that is run by Republicans, the President, Congress, and the Senate. So how you blame Democrats is still, I think people see through that. Paul Ryan, who's doing his thing of if the government shuts down, it's all on the Democrats, that's like ridiculous. And he's abdicating whatever sense of responsibility or leadership that he has to make that kind of statement. I think the real truth is that this is all about the guy in the White House. Without the indefensible comments by Trump recently and his general image and his inability to work with Congress, to me, it's like I'm been through a government shutdown. It's amazing to think, what, 4 or 5 years ago, I remember where there was a
2013.
Shutdown.
2013, uh-huh.
I think the weirdest thing was that it wasn't as bad as people thought it would be. So now people are kind of conditioned to think, well, if government shuts down, we went through the last one, it will end up, you know, fixing it. But that's so dangerous to do every few years that my sense is that, like you said, there's still a lot to go. So I'm going to be in on CNN and checking in and see what's going to happen. I get a hunch there might be some kind of last-minute resolution. I also get a hunch that Trump is going to fly off to Florida and have a party in Mar-a-Lago tonight, regardless of what happens, because that's just how detached he is from things. Well, I hope it doesn't happen, though.
Paul from Eau Claire emailed and said, in the last two government shutdowns, the president came out the winner politically because the public dislikes a do-nothing Congress. President Trump is going to be a clear winner in a government shutdown. Chris Lotto.
I appreciate where Paul's coming from. I don't know if that's 100% true. The fact is, Trump's going to get raked over the coals no matter what. And we've already seen that for the past year. So I don't know that in this particular scenario, with things the way they are, that Trump comes out as the clear winner here. As I said earlier, I do think there's some blame to go around. Republicans will probably shoulder the majority of that. And because, again, of their leadership status. But I'm not sure that Trump comes out a winner here. I think there are certain, there's a pocket of conservatives that are really not going to mind that, you know, beyond essential services, that the government is shut down. And there are certainly some conservatives who are holding on to their positions and refusing to work until they get their say. But that's also true of the Democrats, which gets back to my original point that I think that, you know, to Eugene's point, you can say, it's all the Republicans and it's all Trump, but I don't think that's necessarily true.
Well, the president weighed in this morning tweeting, government funding bill passed last night in the House of Representatives. Now Democrats are needed if it is to pass in the Senate, but they want illegal immigration and weak borders. Shutdown coming. We need more Republican victories in 2018. Excuse me. Chris, is the president right here?
Well, when you're dealing with these situations of we've got to get this thing passed to keep things going for 30 days, you know, obviously the preferable situation is to not try and tie all this other baggage to it, because I think these issues are more complex and you obviously have a variety of different viewpoints that have to be addressed, because certainly the margins in Congress, certainly in the Senate, are razor thin, and there's not a lot of room for folks, hardline conservatives or hardliners on the left to step away, because then you're not going to get any sort of a bill passed. So I think it's clear for political reasons why these things are being attached to, a continuing spending bill. But it just exposes the dysfunction that's in Congress right now, that nobody wants to work with anybody else. And they're willing to take their chances that they're going to come out, you know, looking like a winner if a shutdown does occur.
Well, let's go to Rick now, who joins us from Bessemer, Michigan. Hi, Rick.
Hi there. I was calling in regards just to saying there's a lot of things going on here. Even the Defense Department saying, you know, enough of this. They can't, there's no budgets anymore. They're planning, 3-6 months at a time. The last shutdown cost us $18 billion. We're a nation that's pretty much on our face right now with infrastructure, CHIPS programs. I mean, this is money that could be used so more productively. And to have these guys in Washington and a president flying off to Mar-a-Lago so he can do more of his golfing, and a vice president that's decided he's not going to hold back on the trip. He could be a vote there. Who knows? He doesn't know.
So Rick is saying this is wasteful. Eugene, what do you make of Rick's comment?
No, I think I'm not sure about all of his money figures about how much money was lost during the last shutdown, but I think his point is clear that Americans are kind of fed up with this stuff. And getting back to Trump's tweets, I think because we're on the radio, we ought to make the distinction when we say past and past, P-A-S-S-E-D and P-A-S-T, because I think Trump spelled it wrong in his Trump in his message this morning, which is just another one of the things that's just so infuriating about having a president who can't, you know, spell simple words. I just had to throw that in there.
Well, some Senate Republicans have already said they won't support the bill. Republicans have only a 51-49 advantage. Senator Lindsey Graham, who was one of the lawmakers pushing for a bipartisan immigration deal to go along with a funding bill, said yesterday, last night again, he would oppose any short-term measure, saying, quote, I am not going to support continuing this fiasco for 30 more days by voting for a continuing resolution. It's time Congress stop the cycle of dysfunction, grow up, and act consistent with the values of a great nation. Chris Lotto, what do you think of Graham's feelings about this latest continuing resolution that would possibly get us to February 16th?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. Again, referring to your caller last hour and talking about the rise of the government shutdown, which really is a relatively recent phenomenon that we first really saw
1995.
In the mid-90s. Mm-hmm. So over the last 25 years, which seems to sort of I don't have old polling from before then, but it seems like, you know, as people get increasingly dissatisfied with what's going on in Washington, that this is a really strong indication of the kind of dysfunction that exists. And I think Lindsey Graham is onto something there, that it's time for both sides to just get to the table and, you know, put on their big boy pants and figure something out, that this is no way to run a railroad.
And we are in Week in Review. You're listening to Week in Review. We've got Eugene Kane with us, a former columnist for the Journal Sentinel. And Chris Lotto is here, former communications director for the Republican Party of Wisconsin and a GOP campaign consultant. What news developments do you want to talk about this week? 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. We'll return to the discussion in just a moment on the Ideas Network. It is Friday, and that means it is time for Week in Review. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're breaking down the big stories of the week, turning our attention right now to national politics with Chris Lotto, former communications director for the Republican Party of Wisconsin and a GOP consultant. And Eugene Kane is with us as well, former Milwaukee Journal columnist. And you can join the roundtable as well at 800-642-1234. What do you make of this looming government shutdown? Is there something that you want to see come out of it? Are you concerned? Would you be impacted? 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. So DACA has come up a lot in conversation last hour. We had a lot of discussion about it. Eugene, the measure passed the House last night. It did not address deferred action for childhood arrivals. Do you think that will cause problems as the Senate considers this today?
Well, I think if Democrats basically take a hard stand and really tried to push the issue to get what they want on DACA, it's just going to open the way for more negotiation. And I think the hard line is probably the way to go right now, because I don't think Trump really knows what he wants to do. I think somebody on the Republican side needs to meet up with the people who are hardline on DACA and just basically come up with a solution that goes beyond the politics and deals with more of the humanity of the situation. I think everybody who says that it's wrong to keep these young people as bargaining chips, they are right, but the essential truth is that they are bargaining chips, and you have to use them as such to get what you want. So my sense is that, yeah, it's going to be a problem if they don't include DACA, but that's the way they have to do it, I think.
Chris Lotto?
Yeah, it's difficult to, you know, it's all caught up in this sort of stew of partisanship and Trump hatred and everything else that's all sort of swirling around Washington right now. And that's why I think it's part of the reason why it's so difficult to get anything done. Everybody literally is pointing fingers at everybody else. I think in general, there is agreement that, you know, that some form of DACA needs to continue. We've seen the polls that say Republicans and Democrats want to see it happen. We've seen a general indication of that in Congress as well. You know, part of the issue, obviously, for President Trump is he wants to see the wall built. And yet we're not clear on how that's going to get funded. And so that was kind of a late addition to the process that the president threw in that seems to have, you know, kind of shaken everything up and put us back a little bit on trying to solve DACA and the wall and the other immigration issues. And obviously hardline conservatives in Congress want to see, you know, tougher action on border security as well. So I think if you could separate DACA, I think you could get you know, a deal taken care of and deal with these other things in a different bill or in a different way. But everybody's kind of dug in their heels right now, you know, on all sides. And I think that makes it that much harder. And again, going back to Lindsey Graham's point, everybody's got to come to the table and figure this thing out.
Should the government shut down?
You know, I don't know that it's necessary. I mean, I have a feeling, and I can't say, you know, I have a feeling that they're going to work something out that'll keep the government going for a few days. But that said, will they be even able to get something done in 5 or 6 days or however long a brief extension would be? I don't know that they can. I think they just need more time. And, you know, it's unfortunate because as the elections get closer, everybody's getting into their positions now and they're digging in their heels. And in an election year, you're not going to see as much willingness to bargain as you might have in any other year. So that is yet another factor that you have to weigh in on all this is that politicians want to get reelected. They want to be able to go home and say they stood for what their constituents want them to stand for. And those are obviously in sharp contrast, depending on whether you're a Republican or a Democrat.
Eugene, before we move on to the next topic, final words, should the government shut down?
I tell you, it's going to be a matter of principle and priority. And if people's priorities take, if people's principles take priority over, you know, their elected office, I think if they don't get what they want, they will shut down. If the people who really want these DACA folks to be included don't get what they want, I can't see them budging off of it because that's a principle. This is what America is about.
Well, Lori in St. Francis, will give Lori the last word here. It said, all of the topics today affect real-life people, and that is what is being forgotten. Where is the soul of our country? Meanwhile, earlier this week, White House Chief of Staff John Kelly told Democratic lawmakers on Wednesday that some of President Trump's positions as a candidate on the border wall were, quote, uninformed. However, President Trump said Thursday that his position on building a wall between the U.S. and Mexico had not evolved, tweeting, the wall is the wall. It has never changed or evolved from the first day I conceived of it. He went on to say that the wall will be paid for directly or indirectly by Mexico. Chris, what are your thoughts on this disconnect and where Kelly is coming from?
Well, this is a good question. I'm glad we're talking about this because I think, first of all, Kelly's comments we're hearing through two filters. First filter is Democrats who are coming out of these meetings and telling the press what was said. So I think that, for starters, is you're seeing it characterized through a Democrat filter, and then you're seeing it, secondly, through a media filter. So I think that what Kelly was trying to say is, you know, and we've seen this, virtually every president in modern history, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, has come to office and they found out that they can't necessarily keep their campaign promises. And that is a bipartisan thing. Both parties have done that. That is not a Trump thing. That is a campaign versus reality thing. And I suspect that is the essence of what the Chief of Staff, Kelly, was trying to convey. Now, in an environment where Democrats are seizing every opportunity to sink the Trump administration, the press is going to gobble up any, you know, even hint of internal squabbling. I think you're going to get stories like this. So I think that's playing into this, is that you're seeing this as a Democratic characterization of what John Kelly said to a certain extent. But I also think, yeah, there's a campaign and then there's reality. And we've seen that with every president in modern history.
Eugene, your thoughts, Chief of Staff John Kelly, is this a pivotal moment here of you know, keeping up campaign promise versus what is really the reality on the ground in the Oval Office?
Well, I think John Kelly was basically telling the truth to people that he assumed maybe weren't going to leak it as fast as they did, that we have a president who had a campaign promise that's never going to be fulfilled. There's never going to be a wall between U.S. and Mexico border, like some kind of science fiction wall that's so high nobody can get over it or nobody can under it. That's never going to happen, and it costs too much. And all of the people who shouted it at his campaign rallies, I mean, they got caught up in it. But hopefully when reality sets in, they realize they're never going to have a wall between the U.S. and Mexico. So every time this is brought up now, I just get kind of agitated because I don't think I'm the only one who understands that most of it can't be done because there is no one contiguous border between the U.S. and Mexico. And recently, somebody on a Trump team, I think it was her, Kellyanne Conway, seemed surprised that there's actually rivers and water groups that so you can't have a wall. So, I mean, it's just such a ridiculous thing. There's never going to be a wall. I don't think we should even – well, I know we have to talk about it. But that's what I think whenever I hear it. John Kelly, he was basically trying to wink and nod at these folks and say, listen, we know there's never going to be a wall. But listen, Trump is – he's evolved. So
Chris
was just another ridiculous chapter in his whole presidency.
Chris Lotto, very quickly, will there be a wall?
If the president is determined to get it done, I think some sort of wall will happen. To Eugene's point, yeah, there are parts along the border where you could not put up a wall, and it doesn't make sense to even try, mountains or water or whatever. But if the president wants it to happen and Congress is willing to back him up, I think you could see a wall, absolutely.
This was also the week during which President Trump announced the recipients of the fake news awards. In a speech on the Senate floor, Jeff Flake of Arizona called the president's repeated attacks on the media repulsive, saying President Trump's use of the terms fake news and enemy of the people is shameful and reminiscent of words used by Soviet dictator Joseph Stalin to describe his enemies. Let's listen to Flake.
When a figure in power reflexively calls any press that doesn't suit him fake news, it is that person who should be the figure of suspicion, not the press.
Eugene, what did you think of these awards?
I actually didn't follow up on who got awards because, to me, it wasn't the fake news awards. It was the dumb people's choice awards because Trump's attitude towards the media, it is like some third world dictator. And I think American press can take it. New York Times, Washington Post, all the American papers. But his corrosive effect is overseas, all the journalists trying to do good work overseas, reporting on really, you know, bad dictatorships or even bad fascist countries and trying to keep alive the idea that people need information by Trump labeling everything fake news. And there's already been instances of foreign leaders taking that on to kind of beat down their own press. It's just so corrosive. I mean, and he wants to give out a fake news. Almost every press conference that Sarah Huckabee Sanders holds could be a fake news award. So
Let's get Chris Lotto in here to respond to that.
Well, the fake news thing is a sideshow, and you know, it's kind of dopey, frankly. But is it a threat to the freedom of the press? No, it's not. That's, you know, I can take out my phone. I can look at all the same news sources this morning that I could 2 days ago. I mean, put the fainting couches away. Everybody's going to be fine. I mean, the press is as vital as it's been in a very long time. I'm watching national TV, the Golden Globes, a week ago, and the New York Times is running a national TV ad. I don't think that, you know, writing off the press and saying that the media is dead in this country is absurd. In fact, I think Trump is good for business for a lot of the press, and they're being revitalized as a result, and good for them. I'm a former press guy. I'm a former reporter. I want to see a healthy, you know, journalistic society out there in the U.S., and part of their role is to keep an eye on things and report, when they see issues with Trump that are legitimate. That's the way it's going to be. Now, the fake news You know, if you look at those stories, a lot of them were proven to be false later on. I mean, not every one of them, but a lot of that list
was... The first one was an op-ed piece.
Yeah, the first one was Krugman's piece, which he made a prediction that turned out to be false. He said that the economy was going to tank when Trump got into office, and obviously we're talking about record low unemployment that we haven't seen since 1973 in the U.S. We're seeing the stock market soaring above 26,000 for the first time ever, so, you know, Krugman was wrong. Is that fake news? I mean, it was an op-ed guy who was wrong. So there were other pieces that have been proven to be false in there. Again, you know, not to get too far down this road, but, you know, Jeff Flake, too, is, you know, he's auditioning to be an MSNBC commentator. He's out of the Senate after this year anyway. So he's trying to position himself as the Republican opposition. And I would take everything he says with a grain of salt.
Well, let's let Eugene here respond very quickly before we move on.
Well, I do agree about Jeff Flake because he makes a point of standing up to Trump, yet he votes for everything that Trump proposes. So I don't see. He likes to give speeches, I think.
All right. Well, let's turn to another headline from the week. An emergency alert was sent mistakenly on Saturday to Hawaii's residents warning of an imminent ballistic missile attack when an employee at the State Emergency Management Agency pushed the wrong button. That's according to Hawaii's governor. The alert was issued amid high international tensions, we know, over North Korea's development of ballistic nuclear weapons. Eugene, what stood out to you about this incident?
Well, actually, coincidentally, what we're just talking about, I think the way Trump has spread this fake news mantra, a lot of people were so confused and actually didn't know whether it was true or not. And even though that wasn't a deliberate thing, it's just so scary nowadays because of what Trump's been tweeting about North Korea. Part of your mind could definitely buy into the fact that, oh, wow, something must have happened, and now we're under nuclear attack. Just shows how risky and how, you know, just temperamental having a guy like that as president can be, and how really just frightening. I don't have people in Hawaii, but I can imagine having folks in Hawaii who had to go through that.
Chris Latta?
Yeah, it's an awful story. I mean, the worst part of the whole thing is that, you know, it was apparently a single employee who pushed the wrong button. I mean, it boils down to something as simple as that, and that's all it took to, you know, have an entire state panic and fear for their lives. You know, it certainly sends a message to the states to make sure their system is would not allow such, you know, a terrible but I think ultimately avoidable mistake to happen. But I think it's a reach to start blaming Democrats or Republicans on this. I mean, if you want to go down that road, you know, Hawaii has a Democrat governor, and, you know, North Korea, which is what, you know, people have been pointing to, is, you know, did not just become a threat in the last year. They've been a threat for a long time now. So, but yeah, it's a terrible story, and you know, heart goes out to those folks who are panicking out there, and hopefully Hawaii can address this in a way that something like that wouldn't happen in the future.
Well, you each have about 15 seconds to respond to the last question. President Trump will mark his first year in office this weekend. Chris Latta, how would you rate the president's first year in office?
I think it's been rough, but there are a lot of diamonds in the rough, certainly in terms of the economy, in terms of low unemployment, in terms of a surging stock market, in terms of the judicial appointments. I think there are a lot of good things that President Trump and Republicans could point to, but President Trump has to get out of his own way, set down the phone, stop tweeting so much, and I think there are some good stories to tell.
Eugene, diamond in the rough, what do you make of the president's first year in office?
Very, very disappointing, and I think it actually, he spent a lot of time taking credit for things that the previous administration really should be credited for. I think he's really cast a bad image of America across the world, and the image of the presidency has taken a hit in terms of the character of the people we expect to hold that office.
Well, Chris Latta and Eugene Kane, thank you both so much for making time for us. Chris Latta is a former communications director for the Republican Party of Wisconsin and a GOP consultant. Eugene Kane is a former columnist with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. This Week in Review was produced by Brianne Chasso, Keely Baltina, and Bill Martins. Michelle Johnson is executive producer. Brittany Williams offered technical direction. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is the Ideas Network. Have a great weekend. We'll see you back here on Monday.